Certainly is a pleasure to see each of you who have come tonight to be with us. We appreciate so much the interest you have expressed thus far and continue to show in the work that we are striving to undertake. And that is the understanding of these lovely books of Daniel and Revelation. I appreciate the comments so many of the brethren have made about the many years I've studied these matters and the knowledge that's available. That sounds pretty, and I appreciate it very much, and I want you to know I do. However, there's another side to the picture. The study that I have done has been a little bit one-sided because I've enjoyed it. And I have thoroughly enjoyed digging and searching and finding the things that have been available. And it's made me a better man. It's also made me have a lot deeper and better insight to the marvelous truths that I did not know before. And I hope that the things we're sharing this week have been such that would cause you too to have, and I think by the time we're through with our studies, it will have had that effect, to have a much deeper value for the truths we hold and have a much better appreciation for where we stand, what we are, than we've ever had before. I really think it'll have that effect. But most of all, I think we ought to be thankful for God who saw fit to reveal to us these things. What a marvelous insight we have in these words. What a glorious study it is for us to have to delve into these truths hidden for so many centuries, except as those centuries rolled forward, little by little they were understood. So we appreciate so much God allowing us to see these things and giving us the strength, encouragement, and joy that comes in knowing He cared enough to let us see the events of life as they unfolded. And that's precisely what Revelation is. It's a matter of revealing to the world through picture form, through word pictures and symbols, and things that are not easily understood and are not at that time understood, but only understood as history unfolds them, the beautiful things He had in store for His people. I've said before in other studies, I'm not sure I have in this one, the things in Revelation that seem to be dreadful and very, very difficult, horrible events that it pictures, and some of the things that we seem to cringe about wondering if that's going to happen to us, those things are not intended for us. Those things are intended for and were experienced by those people who oppose God and would not submit to His will. But the marvelous, beautiful things it talks about, the glorious things we can read, they're for our benefit. Revelation and Daniel both, then, are books not to scare us, but to encourage us. They're books written not to cause us to worry and to doubt and be afraid, but on the other hand, to have confidence and strength to forge ahead the marvelous work of serving God. So these books, rather than to discourage, as many people think they do, and rather than to be a picture of doom, as many people take them to be, are certainly not that at all. But their glorious insight to give us strength and encouragement and give us added ambition to go ahead and serve the Christian life, knowing that we cannot be defeated. There's no way we can be defeated with the one who's written these books being beside us as He is to strengthen us along the way. Now, let me add one more thought. I learn as much from these studies as you do. And I've told you already this week, these 2 weeks, that I have learned some things I didn't know when I first began. And so I'm enjoying them, and I appreciate so much you sharing with me the enjoyment, because I see you coming night after night, and that is a pleasure indeed. Now, in order to drive home the point to show you that I'm a human, and I make mistakes, and I learn too, last night I made a mistake, and Heidi was kind enough to call it to my attention, and I appreciate what she did. There were several men around talking and asking questions about things that we discussed, and want to go a little deeper. And she silently and very humbly and very meekly stood aside. And I gathered she had something she wanted to say, but she didn't butt in. She didn't go ahead of anybody. She waited and waited and waited silently. And then she said, "Brother Harry, we've been taught to spell that a different way." And she was right. So I went back home. F-I-E-L-I-I is the way I spell this. Now, I went back last night and I looked into my notes, and every single note I had in this regard, spell the word this way, the same way Heidi said it was to be. And I don't know why in the world I put an E there last night. It shouldn't have been there. So I misspelled that word. So if you made notes of that, by all means, correct that. But as we look tonight to a study of chapters 14, 15, and 16, we, I think, need probably to review just a little bit of where we stand, lest we perhaps leave some people hanging and don't know where we are, because it's been a long study, a very deep study, and one that I think probably you need to get at least a handle on before we proceed further. We've shown that the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation are combined books of prophecy, which simply means they are events that were to happen from that time, and they were yet future at that time. However, history is a matter of something written that records something which has already happened. So prophecy is foretelling future events. History is recording events which have occurred. The way to study prophecy and the way to understand prophecy is simply to look at history. That's the key that unlocks prophecy. Just as simple as that. We can make books of prophecy so outlandish if we wish to. We can draw just about any kind of conclusion, and we can twist things to our own destruction by just allowing them to be fit any way we want to, and that's the way to be confused. And that's the way the world, I say this kindly but sternly, that's the way the world is so confused, and there is so much misunderstanding and conflict and clashing of ideas about prophecy. It's not nearly that hard. It's much, much more simple than we make it. And we invent a number of doctrinal differences and of outlandish predictions and expectations when we take these things and sometimes apply figures literally, and also, on the other hand, to misapply things where they don't fit. But it's not quite that hard. What we've suggested already is that the Lord's Day in the book of Revelation 1:10 really is talking about the day of the Lord, not Sunday. But it's talking about an era of time into which the Lord's church was to experience, and into which it was to be divided into seven parts. We've suggested that the seven churches of Asia, real churches, existing churches, with their problems and their points of commendation as well, were churches that symbolized seven eras of time into which the Christian era was to be divided. This is partly suggested by the characteristics of the various churches, and we've seen unfolded night after night how those various characteristics have prevailed during that era of time. We've shown then also that there's a progressive march forward in time as we study the various chapters. We started with chapter 30. We have continued over chapter 6, which tells us of the fall of pagan Rome, by the seven seals being opened, six of those revealing the fall of pagan Rome. The seventh seal was opened, revealed seven trumpets, and each of those seven trumpets, as they were blown, 1 through 6, revealed the fall of Rome as a major world empire. This was done, as you recall, by the four invasions on Rome proper, the next invasion by Islam on the southern part of the Roman Empire, the third invasion by the Turks on the eastern side of the Roman Empire, and thus the Roman Empire failed in 1453. Now, we stopped in our study at that point because the Bible stopped. Because John stopped in his progress toward the future, and he came, as it were, back in time to 533 and tells us something was going on there and had been developing that we had not yet seen. Now, the reason we hadn't, because it was slow. It was something undercover to start with. It was growing in size and might and effect to where in time it would bloom forth and burst into something great and powerful. But God saw fit to let us see that this would cover a period of 1,260 years. Then, when that 1,260 years was completed, He allows to continue our forward search then, beginning with about 1793 and continue on. And that's where we are tonight. Now notice, if you would, we've come because history has allowed us to do this, and because God predicted these things ahead of time. We've come from the establishment of the church in 30 A.D. all the way up through a series of forward centuries until we've come now to the 18th century, almost the 19th century, to 1793, and that's our study tonight. In the meantime, though, we need to review something else. We've shown that the 1,260 years has been mentioned six times, once by Daniel chapter 7, five times in the book of Revelation, twice in chapter 11, twice in chapter 12, and once in chapter 13. And this period of time is mentioned from several viewpoints. For one thing, the little horn which was to arise is pictured, then the holy city, and then the word of God as the two witnesses, and then the church mentioned twice as the woman. And now, the entire problem has arisen because there is the beast, which is really the forefront of the devil's work against God's people. Now, mentioning this six times, surely God had something in mind for us to see. He didn't just repeat these things for no reason at all. but apparently had a real good object in mind when he said so, when he said this six times. We've noticed then that in the chapter 13, verse 18 of Revelation, he said all this would be cleared up if we could identify a man whose number was 666. Now, we suggested that it's not a big computer in Belgium, and Brother Leland reminded me that it was called the Beast, and that's indeed true. It was. We have seen that it's not the bar emblems you have on the packages which you buy at the store, which also has the symbol 666 on it. We suggested it wasn't a friend of mine who had a car tag having the number 666. We've also seen that it's not Ronald Wilson Reagan, whose name also amounts to 666. If you number the letters in each of his name, it's not that. We've also shown that it could not be Nero Caesar because the time element and the things he did and the effect he had was certainly not at the right time nor had the right effect to become the man of 666. It just didn't fit the qualifications. And no one of these other things have we mentioned. We've shown that if we take the Greek alphabet and spell Latino, so the father of the Latin Empire, even though his name adds up to 666, why, he came on the scene a long, long, long time before our considerations even present. So that couldn't be Latinos. He doesn't fit the requirements. He doesn't fit the time element. He didn't do what this man was to do. He couldn't be that man. We've also shown that even though Adam Clark thinks that it would be the Latin kingdom, and that certainly has a lot of bearing on truth, it's not a kingdom. It has to identify a man, and this, therefore, even if it's in Greek, is certainly not the language probably that would be used, nor does it fit a kingdom. And the Latin kingdom had a lot greater duration than simply what we're talking about, and the Latin kingdom passed away in 1453. So it certainly cannot be talking about something that was not on the scene when this was to occur, so that won't fit. Now, we suggested that it was not in Hebrew, and probably was not in Greek. But since we are talking about something that was on the scene, and God tells us in Daniel 2:44, the Lord's kingdom will be established during the day of the Roman Caesars and will stand forever. And since they had been on the scene, now since they are deposed, but something was to emerge out of the ashes of Rome, let's suggest we try the Latin language. And sure enough, if we go to Latin, we'll notice that even the formula, the alphabetical formula that has numerical value, the first six of these, you could go on to the M for the million and continue, but the first six of those in their progression forward to make 500 add up to 666. The I, the V, the X, L, C, D add up to 666. Maybe then this suggests that the Latin language is what we need to look for. And sure enough, if we use that, we mentioned a number of things last night that would tie in letter C. It would be a person who had this Latin title. But in particular, several references to him, his reference to himself, the tiara that has been worn by him, books in Washington I've looked at, clippings I read last night, mention him as the Vicar of Christ. And if you take the Latin term, vicaris filii dii, and allow the numerical values of these alphabetical numbers, which mean in English the Vicar of Christ, or deity, that brings us up to 666. Showing then that he filled every single qualification that was necessary. He changed times and laws. He seeks to establish himself as God on the earth. He exalted himself above all. And he did all kind of things and strived to accomplish all kind of things suggested by Daniel and Revelation and Paul in Thessalonians and Paul in Timothy and Peter as well. Having all those things fulfilled in his presence and in his nature, and the fact that on top of all that, his name fits 666, we decided then that the Pope of Rome was under consideration. Now, having all that in our minds, we come now to continue in our comments and see what next is on the scene. We've seen that these Catholic powers came to their full bloom in 533. Now, Paul said in Thessalonians, the spirit of iniquity doth already work. So it had begun in Paul's day, and also it had begun, so Paul tells us, back over in Acts 20, because he warned the elders that of some of you that will arise, those who would divide the church in spirit and lead away men after themselves. So it had beginning before this time. But it came to its full bloom in 533 when Boniface I was decreed as being Lord Ecclesiae and Justinian on the throne in Constantinople this time made that decision between the Patriarch in Constantinople or the Bishop of Rome. And thus began the papacy in its full bloom. Now, one thing I need to say, and someone asked this question last night, not to me, but to someone else. Where was the Lord's Church during all that time? Well, the Lord's Church was there. The Lord's Church was present. The Lord's Church has never passed away. Ever since the Lord's Church was established in 33 A.D., ever since that time, there has been a congregation of God's people on the face of the earth. I have material written by a man who was not even aware of anything going on in America, wrote a history of the Lord's Church into what we know of today as Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, Romania, and that part of the world, even way back in the Dark Ages, and continued on up until the Second World War. Now, there's records of God's Church throughout the ages. We have found churches we did not know existed in the eastern part of our nation. And I verily think, and I have some good hopes of finding someday some churches in other parts of the world that we are not working now. I really think they're there. That doesn't prove anything, of course. But the fact is, the Lord's Church was destined to stand forever and not be left to other people like the other kingdoms were around it, but it was to break in pieces, consume all these nations. How would it do that? Well, the Lord's Church didn't have a sword. It didn't break the nations into pieces like Rome broke Greece, and Greece broke Persia, and Persia broke Babylon. Babylon broke Assyria. It didn't break kingdoms into pieces in a military way. But the Lord's Church was to break them into pieces and to break itself into pieces in the sense that it was to mingle among the seeds of men and to influence them so that eventually it would change the minds and the attitudes and the lives of people to turn them toward God and therefore would infiltrate the entire world. That's how the Lord's Church would be victorious. Not with an army, but it was to infiltrate the hearts of honest souls. And as they became members of the Lord's Church and the great spiritual kingdom was established, it would stand forever. Now that's the reason today we found some brethren who are humble, conscientious, dedicated, not looking for a moment for worldly gain, not having a great building with carpets on the floors. In fact, it's dirt. And the houses have restrooms that won't work. And the water is hauled in. Now, that's the kind of situation we found. Of course, we thought we would because we found that all through Mexico. But the fact is, here are people who are dedicated to God's kingdom. Throughout the world, that's what we found. Some of those are meeting God on the first of the week in caves. Some of them in cemeteries or catacombs, as they were called. Some of them in upper rooms. And I know situations in our own general modern day where people have met in buses and each Sunday drove to a different place so the location would not be known by those around. Some of them meeting in secret. God's church has existed throughout the ages. And that's exactly what he meant when he said it'll stand forever. Well, we're going to talk about that tomorrow night. Just want to give you a little sample of it. Tomorrow night we're going to go deeper and deeper and deeper and present some marvelous truths that will just flabbergast a good word, just flabbergast us. Because it will really set us back and let us see that there's a marvelous movement of truth that we are part of. Did you know that we're spoken about in the Bible? Now, I don't mean that we have our name spoken of or even have Sierra Vista mentioned. The name the United States or America is not even mentioned, but the fact is what we are involved in, the exact thing we're involved in this day, the relationship you and I have, the fellowship we have in common, that is spoken of. They are vivid in the Bible, and we'll read about that tomorrow night, and you'll see yourself there. What a glorious thing it is to see those matters. We're not inventing. We're not trying to fabricate some ideas. We're not trying to entice you in things that so many other religionists do, but the fact is, the movement of truth with which we are concerned is mentioned there very vividly, and I want you to see it. We've come then up to our study to a time at which we are about to go forward. We had hesitated here for four chapters to find out the identity of the man of sin, to find out who he was, who he was not. We have found out the movement that had developed, which we have chosen to call a counterfeit, because here are the Lord's people, righteous, true, holy, oppressed, and then there's a counterfeit church. The Lord, the devil desires to raise up. It becomes the church of the day. It becomes the image that people want. It's socially acceptable. And it's the group that takes the dominant power of the day. The Lord church then goes into hiding. It goes into hiding for 1,260 years. But you see, this is not unusual. It's nothing new. And the reason we can be so confident that our understanding here is true is the fact you know this same thing happened back in old Israel. You remember that was Saul the king, and he displeased God, and the kingship fell to his son-in-law David, the proper tribe. And from that time, the proper kingship never changed. David died, Solomon, his son, took reins of the government, each of those reigning 40 years. And then when Solomon died, his son Rehoboam became the righteous king. But Jeroboam arose, and he wanted to take the kingship for himself. He split Israel, you recall, into two groups, the northern group and the southern group. Jeroboam then went up north and established not one but two places to worship God, instead of one like Jerusalem. He established false priests who didn't have the proper credentials. He established false festival days. He established false altars and false sacrifices. But the whole thing looked like what was proper and right back in Judah. He established a counterfeit Israel. He even took the right name and called this counterfeit Israel. But the southern two tribes took the name Judah. It was from these tribes the Lord would emerge. And sure enough, in 721, the 10 northern tribes were captured by Assyria and assimilated among the Gentiles. You see, that happened once, way back in 721, up to about 980 B.C. The same thing's happening again. The devil comes along, he invents a counterfeit church, an apostate church, a church that went along after the dictates of the devil that looked like and sounded like and had all the appearance of and claimed to be the Lord's church, but it was a church in digression. Now, that's what we've identified, what the Lord has let us see in chapters 11, 12, and 13. And that's the reason why in chapter 11, verses 1 and 2, he tells us to take the measuring reed. In chapter 10, he tells us that measuring reed is the Word of God. Now, that's how we know the truth. Not by my feelings or what my grandparents did or what's socially acceptable, but only by the Word of God. And that's how we can determine what's right and proper. Therefore, having learned all this, we're ready to proceed forward now in chapter 14. I looked, and behold, a lamb stood on the Mount Sion, and with him 144,000, having his father's name written in their foreheads. I heard a voice from heaven saying, as the voice of many waters, and as the voice of a great thunder, and I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps. Of course, these terms simply let us understand we have the depth and the magnitude and the glory of Almighty God being expressed here. And they sung, as it were, a new song before the throne, before the four beasts, which we understand are living creatures, and the elders, 24 elders. And no man could learn that song but the 144,000 which were redeemed from the earth. Who are they? Well, chapter 7 has already told us, but we're going to look at it again. These are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb. These are the first fruits. We have seen the 24 elders represent the Old Testament children of God, and the other 12 represent the 12 apostles, or the New Testament era children of God. And in heaven, they're going to be all of God's family, whether they were Jews or whether they are Christians who had been Gentiles. Whatever, we have become the first fruits of God. And these, no doubt, have a lot to do with those Jews to whom Christ first came, and then to the Gentiles who later came, since the Jews basically rejected him. Christ came to his own, John says, and his own received him not. But to them who did receive him, to them he gave you the power to become the sons of God, even to those who believe in his name. And then Paul said in Romans 1:16, I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, but the power of God's salvation to everyone that believeth, the Jew first, and also to the Greek. So here we have under consideration the approach. In their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on the earth, to every nation and kindred and tongue and people. And it said with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment is come, and worship him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of waters. And this gives us the picture then, that as chapter 7 did, we have 144,000 are the redeemed from Israel, and then a greater number from the Gentile world who are God's anointed because they have been able to select him and obey him. That was in chapter 7. This is in chapter 14. Now watch this. We have a beautiful picture in Revelation. No man could have decided this. No man could have all dreamed up what we're talking about. You see, chapter 7 falls within an area between chapter 6 and chapter 8 where we have the destruction of pagan Rome. Then there's silence for 30 minutes, Revelation said, before we see the destruction of imperial Rome. Now, having seen the destruction of imperial Rome, we have a division in chapter 14 now. That lets us see a period of time before the destruction of imperial Rome and the destruction of papal Rome. So before these great onslaughts of destruction come against the forces of evil, God injects chapter 7 and chapter 14. And more or less a time of waiting, time of silence, time of hesitation, before the great wind of destruction falls upon the forces of evil. Chapter 7 divides pagan Rome and imperial Rome as being destroyed. Chapter 14 divides imperial Rome and papal Rome as being destroyed. Look at the next verse now. And that followed another angel saying, Babylon is fallen, is fallen. Well, I thought Babylon had fallen a long time ago. In fact, it did. It was destroyed a long, 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 long time ago, in the days of Father Nebuchadnezzar. But you see, we're not talking about old Babylon. And when we, from this point forward, look at Rome, we're not talking about the old city of Rome. It's long since been diminished. Long since has lost its importance. But now we're talking about the resurrected Rome, which at this time is a spiritual entity. Just as we looked at Jezebel. And we'll look at Jezebel. We find Jezebel is a symbol of wickedness, of rebellion against God, as following paganism and enticing God's people to do what's wrong, like in chapter 3. So you see, we're taking Old Testament characters and we're bringing them forward, and in doing so, we're using them as symbols or examples. That's not unusual. Peter did that in 1 Peter, you remember, where he talks about the time of Noah and the ark. And Hebrews does that many a time when it talks about the priest of old and the priesthood of Jesus Christ. Talks about the Melchizedek of the Old Testament and the priest and king of the New Testament, Jesus Christ. So you see, symbols here are used simply to emphasize and bring forward and drive home a great truth he wants to see. So Babylon here is not old Babylon. That's long since past. We've forgotten about. But this is the new rebellious group of people. Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. Here's the Roman Catholic power. Here's the Pope behind it all, and we'll see later on. And this was that evil, corrupt, sinful, abominable city that, as we spoke about the city of God being the Lord's church, here's that great city that influenced the entire world to drink into her fornication. And this, of course, is talking about the Roman Catholic powers. The third angel now comes on the scene. He followed them, saying with a loud voice, if any man worship the beast and his image. So you see who we're talking about? Not talking about real Babylon at all. We're talking about the beast and his image, which we've identified already. If any man worship the beast and his image and receive his mark in their forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation. And he, the one who drinks this, shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. So here we have a warning to beware and not become part of this evil, corrupt, adulterous spiritual movement, which is Rome. As I mentioned last night, no doubt there were some in France who were not party to opposing the Bible and following the dictates of such men as we'll talk about in a few moments, as Rousseau or Voltaire or Thomas Paine or some of those other men who rose at that time. They were honest, simple, probably farmers way out in the rural area who every day they went out in the field and planted a seed or cultivated a crop or milked a cow or got an egg from a chicken. They could see God in creation. They could see God everywhere they looked, and they were not about to turn against God. Throughout the ages, we've seen those people, and we'll talk about some of those tonight. But the fact is, there were those, though, who were so bold and they were so forward in opposing God. He's talking about these kind of people. We're not talking about sincere, honest people who are seeking God. We're talking about those rebellious ones. You remember Jezebel? She told Ahab, her husband, in effect, she said, how stupid you are. You're the king. Go take that piece of land if you want it from Naboth. He turned his face to the wall and was going to sulk like a little schoolboy who had his feelings hurt. Jezebel said, I'll get it for you. So she got two witnesses, and she caused these lying witnesses to condemn Naboth. They killed him and took the property and brought it in and gave it to her husband Ahab. See what Jezebel did? Here's the kind of people we talk about. We're talking about those who rebel against God, care nothing for truth or righteousness. Well, they are prone to follow their ways of spiritual adultery to the ultimate end. Now, verse 11 continues, the smoke of their torment ascended up forever and ever, and they had no rest day nor night, who worship the beast and his image, and whosoever receiveth the mark of his name. We talked about the mark last night. We showed the mark simply means submission to Rome and whatever we do to indicate our submission to it. It might be worshiping a false understanding, an idea. It might be the mark of the cross. It might be wearing the smut on our forehead during the time of Lent. It might be observing festive days such as Christmas and Easter. It could be calling the priest father. It could be a number of things that today we look at with not much attention, but really show that the Pope has influence in our lives if we let those things dictate what we do and where we go and how we act. And used to, it would be to abstain from red meats on Friday, but that law has been changed. Then verse 12 says, here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. And I heard a voice from heaven saying to me, write. Now here's what we need to hear. Blessed are the dead, which time the Lord hath henceforth, yea, said the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, and the worst do follow them. There will be some children of God who will not fare well when persecutions and problems come, and there are a host of those. We can name you some. God's people throughout the ages whose names have been written in their own blood because they stood and dared stand for truth. But there are so many thousands of saints that we don't know the name of and never will know the name of because they died without being known. They died in obscurity. They died and only probably their family and a few around them ever even knew they lived. But God knows who they are. The same thing's true with us. God knows what we're doing, where we are, how we're acting, our success, and our works are going to follow us. So don't worry about whether you're seen or not seen. The fact is God knows, and that's the important thing. Stand for truth wherever you are, no matter what you face. God knows it, and that's what counts. They rest from their labors, and their works do follow them. And I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and upon the cloud one set like to the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, his hand a sharp sickle. Brother Moria has a sickle on his front porch. It has a hand hole and a semicircle blade on it. That's one kind of sickle. There's another kind of sickle. And this kind of sickle has a long, crooked handle. It has an auxiliary handle on it where you put your left hand, or as the case might be, whichever way you are, and another place to hold your hand, and it's just right, just fits, twisted just right. Then it has a long, slightly curved blade with a point on it. And you go out into the wheat, or the rye, or the barley, and you run the sickle through there, and it cuts off the stalk near the ground. And then it falls back in a cradle made for that purpose. And at the end of that sweep, you gather the wheat, or the rye, or the barley together, into a bundle, and you tie it together, and there's your sheaves. And you stack your sheaves out in the field. Do you have those things out here in Arizona? You did in Kansas, you did in Tennessee, and Kentucky, and Pennsylvania, and Maryland. All through that area of the world, you used to have those. That's the only way it was done. Of course, I know you have your monstrous machinery out here now with tires so large that I hate to have to change one. But anyway, that's the change we've made. But he's describing the old, old way of doing things. Now, a sheave is that which is gathered, to be taken to the barn. But the sickle is that which cuts that which is to be gathered. And the sickle is that which at the proper time harvests whatever's good. And from that, there is a throwing of the grain up in the air, so the wind will blow away the chaff, and the good head of grain will fall back down. So he's just picturing here a harvest that's about to be done. Now watch this. God harvested by the time of the pagan Rome. God harvested at the time of Imperial Rome, and God's about to harvest again. Now we have in this chapter a very beautiful picture of the reaper coming through, who's Christ, and watch what he does. Another angel came out of the temple, verse 15, crying a loud voice to him that sat on the cloud, thrust in thy sickle and reap, for the time is come for thee to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. Christ comes now with a sickle. He's about to reap this earth and gather into God's barn the good wheat and to destroy the shaft. And he that sat on the cloud thrust in his sickle on the earth, and the earth was reaped. Another angel came out of the temple which is in heaven, he also having a sharp sickle. Now watch this. The first one gathered the good crop. Look at the next one. Another angel came out from the altar which had power over fire, and cried with a loud cry to him that had the sharp sickle, saying, thrust in thy sharp sickle, and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. And the angel thrust in his sickle the earth, gathered the vine of the earth, and cast it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. You see how he's gathering in that which is not pleasing to God. He's gathering in that which needs to be destroyed. God's people are always gathered by God and taken care of by him, but the wicked also are gathered by him and thrust where? In the great wine press of what? The wrath of God. So they're going to suffer God's wrath in their reaping. Now this is interesting because verse 20 is taken out of its context and just twisted every way in the world but loose by those who want to make something awful and dreadful out of Revelation that you ought to be afraid of. You don't need to be a bit afraid of this if you're serving God like you should. And the wine press was trodden without the city, because you remember Christ was crucified without the city. This seems to illustrate something that's to be destroyed, our refuge, our trash, our dead bodies, are to be taken outside the cities, into the rubbish dump and burned. This pictures the destruction of those who are wicked. And wine press was trodden without the city. You know how you tread a wine press? Today we don't do it that way in our country, but they do in other parts of the world still. They take their shoes off and they clean their feet and they walk up and down on their grapes. And after a while they are squished and squeezed and the grape juice runs out. And that's what he's talking about. They're pressed that way and then the wine, or the juice in this case, before it's wine, begins to run out. Let's say that again. The wine press was trodden without the city and blood. What? I thought we were talking about grapes. And then he says blood came out of them. How can that be? Have you ever seen blood come out of a grape? I haven't. Now that's the problem. You see, we're talking about symbolic language. And when we take this blood here, as the next part of this verse tells us, to symbolize the actual battle that's going to occur, and the blood is going to be as deep as a horse's bridles, you misconstrue it. Watch it again. Blood came out of the winepress, even unto the horse's bridles, by the space of 1,600 furlongs. So here we have a description of a great destruction. Here we have a description of things that would give to us an idea of a battle. Now, 1,600 furlongs would amount to about 144 miles. Can you imagine something being as deep as a horse's bridle, 144 miles long, and how wide didn't tell us? I think that we can understand this if we look at another verse of Scripture. And this is of an Old Testament reference that I think you can relate to, 2 Kings chapter 21 and verse 16. 2 Kings 21:16. If you might make a note, you might want to mark that down because this will give a reference when you talk to others around us about this verse to explain this verse. So at verse 20, mark if you would 2 Kings chapter 21 verse 16. Brother Bill, you've been to Jerusalem. Brother Oliver, did you go? I knew somebody. Was it Sewell? I knew somebody went with you. I don't know how many of you have been there before. You remember going to the old city of Jerusalem? You remember the wall around it, the old city. The new city has an airport out there and has other things, cafes, and you can eat outside. They even have buses and you name it. But the old city has a wall around it. has gates into it. You remember how it looked inside? You couldn't walk very far without taking a step. Take a step up this right, make a turn up another little alley, take another step up. It's not level at all. It's just a very, very rough city. Now, if we would take blood and put into that city, you think it'd stay there? You think it'd run out somewhere? Wouldn't stay there, would it? Now, with that in mind, listen to this verse. Moreover, Manasseh, who was the evil king of Judah, shed innocent blood very much till he had filled Jerusalem from one end to the other. You just couldn't do that. Because there's no way blood would stay in Jerusalem. It oozed out the gates. It'd sink into the ground. It'd go out of wells. There's all kinds of things. Somebody corrected me the other day. You don't say whale down here. You say well. Okay, anyway, the hole that has water in the bottom of it. I have to overlook my southern speech. But anyway, there's no way that Jerusalem could hold blood from one end to the other. You see, this is a figure of speech. This is a way of saying, I've had it up to here. What does that mean? How can you have it up to here? Well, that's an expression we use to say I'm just plumb disgusted. All right, that's what he was saying here. Now, in the book of Revelation chapter 14, the wine press was trodden without the city. Blood came out of the wine press, even of the horses' bridles, by the space of 1,600 furlongs. Just unbelievable. He's trying to tell us here the wrath of God and how that, notice this, you don't get blood out of wine, out of grapes. You don't get blood out of grapes. You don't get blood out of grapevines. He's using here a figure of speech. He's using a symbol here. So don't try to take this and use it to try to show some enormous battle, as our sectarian friends do. It doesn't talk about that. He's talking about the destruction of God in an awful situation that prevails. And, of course, we're talking about blood from the wine press in that. We're talking about humans as opposed to grapes. But that's precisely what we're under consideration. Having now in chapter 14 seeing this silence, this time of explanation, before we actually see the plague that's going to fall, look at chapter 15 now. I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels having the seven last plagues, for in them is filled up the wrath of God. The seven what? Seven last plagues. We have here the first destruction, the second destruction, and the third destruction. We have here the seven seals, the seven trumpets, the seven vials. Watch this again. The six seals are open. The seventh seal reveals nothing historical, but it shows seven trumpets. The six trumpets are blown. The seventh reveals nothing historical, but points to seven vials. The six vials are poured out. What do you expect the seventh to do? Same thing the others did? The seventh seal pointed to seven trumpets. The seventh trumpet pointed to seven vials. The seventh vial points to what? Not a thing. The seven last plagues? Now, tomorrow night, no, probably not. Saturday night, we're going to show you where we are. We're going to show you that we're right here. Seven last plagues? Does that sort of scare you? Now we'll go a little farther. And I saw, as it were, a sea of glass mingled with fire. Here we have a sea or a basin of glass which the priest would have used, of water which the priest would have used to wash their hands before they administered. But it's of glass. It's solid. It's unshakable. It's clear. But it's mingled with fire, showing the purity and the perfection of God and his purposes. And them that had gotten the victory over the beast and over his image and over his mark and over the number of his name stand on the sea of glass having the harps of God. And they sang the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb. Here again you have the 12 elders on one side, the 12 on the other side. You see, when I mentioned the 24 elders earlier, I realized that I had to mention this several times because over and over and over again, God brings to us through John the idea that we have the Old Testament children, the New Testament children, all making the family of God involved in this. So you have Moses on one hand, representing the Old Testament, and you have the Lamb on the other hand, representing the New. Great and marvelous are thy works, Lord God Almighty. Just and true are thy ways, thou King of saints. Who shall not fear thee, O Lord, and glorify thy name, for thou only art holy. For all nations shall come and worship before thee, for thy judgments are made manifest, or open that it can be seen. John says, after that I looked, and behold, the temple of the tabernacle of the testimony in heaven was opened. The seven angels came out of the temple, having the seven plagues, clothed in pure and white linen, having their breasts girded with golden girdles. Here the purity and the evidence that these are from God. One of the seven, four beasts gave unto the seven angels seven golden vials full of the wrath of God who liveth forever and ever. The God who lives forever and ever gives these vials now of wrath to be poured out. Now verse 8 says, the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from His power. Do you remember back at the time of the building of the temple in the Old Testament? The building of the temple was a marvelous thing. There was not a single piece of metal tool heard to be striking a stone. It was built in silence or reverence. As I recall the story, it took over 7 years to build. And as I recall, I haven't even looked at this lately, out of 180,000 workmen, and there seemed to have been 7,000 bosses over them. I stand to be corrected on that. I'm just going from memory now. And it took a little over 7 years to build that. It must have been a marvelous, marvelous temple. But when it was done, and there were literally hundreds of thousands of oxen and sheep sacrificed here at that time. And when that was done, the Bible tells us in the Old Testament that the Spirit of God filled that temple and no man could enter into it. God's Spirit filled that temple. That's what we're finding now. We're finding that the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from His power, and no man was able to enter into the temple till the seven plagues, the seven angels were fulfilled. These things had to occur before the end of time came. These things had to occur before the evil of papal Rome had been destroyed. Now, the people back in John's day didn't know when the end of time was coming. The people who lived in the Dark Ages didn't know when the end of time was coming. And the people today don't know when the end of time is coming. We just don't know. God has never revealed to men when that was. But God's people throughout the ages have always lived with the knowledge that Christ could come at any time. I'm going to take this chance and take another 5 minutes. I think it's important. Some time ago, there was an expedition down to the South Pole. The leader of the expedition was from England, and he led his men into an area and placed them on an ice pack where it could be dangerous. And sure enough, it was. Because the ice sealed them in, and there was no way for him to reach them. So he promised, I will come back after you. And this little handful of men on that ice pack goes back to the first part of our century. Stayed there. And they waited. And they waited. And they waited and they waited and waited. And the supplies were getting low. But they continued to wait and to watch. And one day, when the ice had parted just enough, and there was enough melt for him to ram the ship into where they were, he did so. And the men on the ice fall scrambled on board the ship. He pulled back out before the ice came together again. They were saved. And he asked the question, how did you know to be ready? At that moment, I might be there and get on board the ship. If I had not come then, you'd never been saved. They said, because our leader told us the boss might come back today. Be ready. Every day be ready, because he might come today. And they were ready. And when the admiral came, they were spared. True story. Take the details if you want to someday. And that's the case for Christians. You see, throughout the ages, God has allowed us to know that Christ is to return. The end of the world will come. He doesn't tell us when, but He tells us this, be prepared. Because when I come, it'll be as a thief in the night. And throughout the entire Christian age, God's people have always known it could come tomorrow. Now, you and I know today that it wasn't going to come tomorrow. It wasn't going to come for almost 2,000 years, but they didn't know it. We don't know it today. It could be tomorrow. It could be 20 years. It could still be 200 years, it could be 500 years. And the reason why is because we're not able to look in the future, and I don't know how long it's going to be between 6 and 7. It'll come. And we're in the last of the last days. But I must hasten. You say I had 2 hours tonight. Is that right? All right. Verse 1, chapter 16. And I heard a great voice out of the temple saying to the seven angels, go your ways and pour out the vials of the wrath of God upon the earth. So, we now have been looking for something, and it's here. We're about to see what it is. Now, here's this beaker, or this vial, that's been poured out, and the wrath is coming out from it to be poured upon the forces of evil. So we know this is not for Christians. What is it for? Or what we've been preparing from chapter 10, 11, 12, and 13 to expect, and that is papal Rome. He's identified who it is. He told us the number of the man, his name. He told us what he would do, how he would act, what he behaved, what he claimed to be. All this has been prepared for, and now we're about to see the wrath of God poured out. The first angel went with his vial of wrath and poured out his vial upon the earth. And there fell a noisome and grievous sore upon the men which had the mark of the beast and upon them which worshipped his image. We have come in time, as we have seen, to 1453. Therefore, we know now, since we have come back and prepared ourselves to go forward, we're not going backward. So in all indications, we must look forward to see what might have been an earth-shaking event upon the forces of evil. And everything's pointed to the fact it must be upon the papacy and upon the Roman Church, the apostate church. We mentioned the other night that various cities of the world have had at one time or another a very prominent place. There was at this time, growing at this time, a vie for power between France on one hand and England on the other. You can read this back in English literature, and a very interesting reading about the days that we're talking about. Rome has long since lost its glory. Constantinople has lost its glory because it's been conquered, but France now has become the elite city of the world. City of beauty, city of history, city of science, city of medicine, city of literature, city of music, city of art, you name it, Paris had it. And they knew it. But one of the main things about Paris is that they had been so strangled by the power of Rome that the people rose in rebellion. Let me see if I can read some things so I can find where it was about this. The date this author talks about is July 14, 1789. He's preparing for an event that took place in 1792, September. But I want to mention to you some things about the condition of Paris and of France because of that city. The 26 million people of France were divided into three classes, or three states. The clergy, some 130,000. 130,000 clergymen. The nobility, some 400,000. And the third estate, which included everybody else. Three divisions in France, three sects of people. Most of the population lived in dire poverty, while the richest class, now watch this, while the richest class was the ecclesiastical hierarchy, cardinals, archbishops, bishops, and abbots. The lower clergy, the priest, were among the poorest, and in the revolution they joined the common people against their own superiors. While the French government neared bankruptcy, the French church, which owned about 20% of the property in France, hoarded its wealth, earning the resentment of the impoverished masses. Now, that just gives you an idea of what I want to say. The Roman Catholic powers had become so dictatorial, so dominating, so concerned with their own ego and desire for recognition and wealth and position and power that they had actually turned the people against them. So the French Revolution really boiled down to the fact they were resenting the power of the church. And they turned on the power of the church. And the French Revolution, since the church had been so corrupt and so sinful and so evil and so dominating and had taken the masses' money and hoard it for themselves, since that had happened, the people were willing to see a change made. Therefore, they accepted people, as we mentioned earlier, who decided to follow the goddess of reason, the age of reason, as opposed to the age of clerical power. So they turned against religion and outlawed the Bible. And you remember the other day, for 3.5 years, the two witnesses, the Old and New Testament, were trampled underfoot. And then God, in 1796, allowed them to come back to life again. And sure enough, once again, French realized what they had done. After slaughter of all kinds of people, nobility and ecclesiastical power being brought to an end, the people once again allowed the Bible to return. Beautiful story of the French Revolution. Read about it in your library and you'll see it. One of the first to die was King Louis XVI. His head was the first cut off by the guillotine. And the man who issued the statement to the effect that The revolutionary government must act like a thunderbolt. They begin to take men, give them a fake trial, would not have any recourse at all to decision made. Eventually started slaughtering the nobility and those they resented, to finally the last was the man who made this statement. He died himself in the guillotine. Bloody masses during those days. Again, you can read about it in your history, but that's what we're talking about. In 1792, September, I'm putting 1793 there for a general date, the French Revolution took place. And this is where God poured the wrath out upon France, which was at that time the elite city, the elite nation of the Holy Roman Empire and of the papacy itself. So the wrath is poured out now in the French Revolution at that time. As we continue on, we'll see verse 3. The second angel poured out his vial upon the sea, and it became as the blood of a dead man, and every living soul died in the sea. Now, what's the similarity? You see back over here an imperial Rome. The first invasion was from the earth, just like this one had to do with the earth. The next invasion for imperial Rome came from the sea. You remember on the map to the right, to your right, we find where the Vandals came down through Central Europe, crossed the Straits of Gibraltar, ended up at Carthage and waited there some 26 years, built ships and crossed and attacked Rome from the sea. You have here really a duplication. All at different times, surely. Different people, but they have a duplication of it. That's one reason we can see so clearly what took place here. And sure enough, at this time, beginning in the 1790s and going up to 1805, there was a great conflict between the sea powers of, now watch this, Italy, Portugal, Spain, and France, the great Catholic powers of the day who bordered the sea, either the Mediterranean or the straits between England and Europe, and they had domain over the land of the world from the seas which touched the Caribbean islands in the west all the way over to India in the east. They dominated the seas in those days, these four powers did. France, Spain, Italy, and Portugal. So they amassed great navies, or a great navy, and of course, over the horizon was London and England. And England was rising at this time, and they were to meet. Inevitably, they would meet. And that actually happened. This took place in 1805 at a place called Trafalgar. And there was a great battle. I wish you could read what I have in my hand. It's a record of the battle took place at that time. It tells how the ships were arranged, shows where they were placed, shows how many were involved with it. Not a single British ship was sunk. They were hurt. And then a great storm that came up, they had difficulty staying afloat, but they did. And about 18 ships of the French and those powers were defeated. Admiral Horatio Nelson was the man of the day. He was the admiral of the British Navy. He was fighting from his flagship Victory. And near the end of the battle, so I'll read to you, at about 1:15 p.m., Nelson fell. A bullet fired by a marksman in the mizzle top of the roundable had entered his left shoulder and lodged in his spine. Carried below, he died 3 hours later, but not before learning he had won a glorious victory. And the powers of the Catholic Navy never again were a threat. He completely broke the power of France and Spain and Portugal and Italy and the Catholic powers in 1805, the Battle of Trafalgar. Here is where the Catholic sea power was brought to an end. You see what I'm talking about? We've been prepared to see the Roman Catholic powers as a great threat against the truth, the great counterfeit church, and now God's pouring his wrath out upon them, first of all by the land and next by the sea. And then something arises which sometimes happens in the world. And you wonder, is that luck? I don't believe in luck. I don't believe for a moment in luck. No such thing as luck. We use that word like we use the word debt. I used the word bet the other night just as a matter of trying to impress you to drive a point home. Luck. What's luck? Chance. Mysticism. I don't believe in luck at all. God Almighty has his hand upon God's people and everything we do. He knows about everything we do or have to do with. And every blessing that comes our way, we must submit to him as the Father of lights. There's no variance, no shadow of turning. Every good and precious gift is from him. There's a man in our nation some years ago who lost just about everything he tried to do. If he'd have run from the dog catcher, he'd probably lost. Just about everything he tried to do, he lost. He was a failure. The fact is, he was a very fine young man. I've been to the house where he was reared. He was a man who had a wife to be, and everything looked just beautiful and rosy, but she died just before they married. Later on, he married another wife who never was any help to him at all. Always a thorn in his side. But that might have made him what he was. It might have caused him to have strength that he never would have had otherwise. But eventually, at the right time, the right place, and the right circumstances, just when he and what he was made of was needed, he was elected president by the United States. One of the greatest presidents we ever had, ever will have, in Abraham Lincoln. Now, just before this was another man who rose on the scene. He was from Corsica. He was a little fellow, not very large. He was a lieutenant. He was a man who had intelligence. He had all kind of insight. He was just ideal in every way as far as his intellect was concerned. He was at the right time, the right place, and the right circumstances, and he was thrust to the forefront of the French army. At 27, he became a general. And he marched all through Central Europe. You remember in the case of the trumpets? We had the third trumpet blow, and we had an invasion which came through from Asia, and this invasion had to do with the heads of the waters, the rivers of Central Europe, and finally he invaded Rome, sacked it, and then went back home again. The fact is, though, his conquest was in Central Europe, and that's exactly what happened with Napoleon. Napoleon came down from France. He took control of the rivers and the heads of the waters all through Central Europe, conquered those, and then headed down toward Italy. He conquered Italy, and in conquering Italy, he took the Pope as captive, took him back over to France. But let's read the next verse. The third angel poured out his vial upon the rivers and fountains of waters, and they became blood. And I heard the angel of the waters say, Thou art righteous, O Lord, which art, and wast, and shall be, because thou hast judged thus. For they, those who were in this area, who made up now the ten horns of the beast, the Catholic nations of Europe, and we could name a number of those, you'd know who they would be, of course, Germany, Switzerland, France, Italy, and even eventually England and Scotland, Scandinavia, and Germany. Now these in Holland, these were the nations we're talking about. And they had, it says, shed the blood of saints and prophets, and thou hast given them blood to drink, for they are worthy. You see, the Pope had sway and power, we discussed the other day, where Charlemagne came on the scene in 800 and established again the Roman Empire. This time, though, it was called the Holy Roman Empire. So where the Pope had sway and power and might in an ecclesiastical way, then Charlemagne came and gave a sword in the hand of the Pope by establishing the Holy Roman Empire. So all these nations arose and gave military might to the Pope so nobody stood in his way. He did what he wanted to do. He went where he wanted to go. Anything he wanted was in his hand for 1,260 years. For 1,260 years, nobody opposed the Pope. He had complete sway. All of a sudden, these nations begin to turn on him. We'll discuss that in chapter 17. All these nations begin to turn on him, and one by one, he failed. And the last one of these that really brought him to his knees is France. And that's the reason we're reading about it now. They have shed the blood of saints and prophets. Thou hast given them blood to drink, for they are worthy. In this area of the world, which we're reading about just now, were people who were called the Albigenses, the Waldenses, the Hussites, and there were others. Now, these terms we use because they are the names of men who led movements of truth back in those days. We might think, well, now, we shouldn't call ourselves after a man's name. Hussites, I wouldn't call myself after a man named Huss. Or Waldensians, I wouldn't call myself after Peter Waldo. Of course we wouldn't. We know better than that. The fact is, the world has coined these terms like you coined the term Campbellite and call us by that term. We don't call ourselves by that, and they didn't either. You see, these people back in those days were God's children. They were faithful and dedicated, and in many, many, many ways, they upheld the truth just as we know it. Now, they had some error. The error crept in, as it does in every movement, in every age, and it does in the Lord's church today. But these were steadfast people of God who had burned the stake. They were locked in church buildings, men, women, and children in the church set on fire, and they were burned alive in the church building. There were women back in those days who had their children snatched from their arms and thrown up in the air and put a lance or a spear at it. When it came back down, it pierced the child in front of the woman. Pregnant women ran through with spears and swords because they would dare stand for truth and not deny the Lord and confess the Pope. All kind of atrocities were done back there in those days, and that's exactly what's happening here. God is saying, because in Central Europe, all these things were done in the name of God, and it was a counterfeit religion and a false religion, an adulterous religion, God's going to take vengeance on those, and he did, because he used Napoleon for that end. Just like he used Nebuchadnezzar, like he used Cyrus, and like he has used Alexander, so God now uses Napoleon. And of all things, Napoleon was a believer in God and God's word. He was corrupt. He sinned. He didn't uphold the truth as we know it, but he did believe in God. And he served God because God put him in the right place at the right time to do these things. And then he came down into Italy. He conquered Italy. He took the Pope, this is in 1796 and 1797, he took the Pope captive and took the Pope up to Paris. That had never been done before. Nobody had ever so insulted a Pope as this. He took him back up into Paris where the Pope died. Now we continue on. And I heard another out of the altar say, "Even so, Lord God Almighty, true and righteous are thy judgments." And the fourth angel poured out his vial upon the sun. Sun? Remember earlier, several times we've talked about the sun. We're not talking about the beautiful sun outside that rises in the east and sets in the west, nor the moon and the stars that we see in the natural heavens above us. We're talking about great luminaries. You remember, way back in old times, Joseph was spoken of as the sun, his wife as the moon. We've mentioned this several times. A number of times the Bible speaks about humans or governments in terms that would look like it were a natural phenomenon of some kind, but we're not talking about that. We're talking about a great figure who illuminated the world, or he thought he did, and he did for those who believed in him. This is the Pope. Now watch what happens. He poured his vial upon the sun, and power was given unto him to scorch men with fire. And men were scorched with great heat, and blasphemed the name of God, which hath power over these plagues, and they repented not to give him glory. In 1798, Pope Pius VI was taken as a prisoner to France, where he died. The next pope was elected in 1799, where? Okay, Napoleon had conquered Italy. Rome was under the thumb of the French. They could not elect a new pope in Rome, which they had always done, which is still being done today. They couldn't do that, so they elected a new pope up in Venice, of all places. You see, now the great luminary has begun to lose its shine, its power. Now the pope has died. Now a new pope has to be selected. He couldn't be selected where he ought to be. So you can see now the wrath being poured on Rome, and they're losing their glory. They're losing their power. They're losing their significance. Their domination has been taken away. The next year, the French allowed him to come back to Rome again. Notice this. He didn't come by his own great authority he'd one time ruled the world with. He came on the power and the authority and the permission of Rome. And the Pope was allowed to return in 1800. But the significant thing is that in 1804, when it was time for this little 27-year-old general, who had now become older in age and become much more powerful, and now was about to attack the world, and could only be defeated by Wellington at the Battle of Waterloo, the British Army. He had become now the state at which he needed to be crowned as emperor. And who of all people did he select to crown him? You know, he's the man of power. He's the man of the day. He's the man to look to. He's the man who is supreme. He calls down for the Pope in Rome and says, "You come up here and crown me." Have you ever seen humiliation? Have you ever seen the sun darken? That's the darkness of it. This great power of the Pope, all of a sudden, who calls himself Lord God on the earth, he's commanded by an earthly general, "Come over here and do what I tell you to do." That's humiliation. That's exactly what this is talking about in 1804. So we come now to the French Revolution. We come to the Catholic sea power being destroyed. We see Italy taken now by the power of this French army. Now we see the Pope humiliated. This brings us up to 1804, not too far away from our time. We have seen God's wrath now poured out four times upon this wicked power, the Roman Catholic Church. That's not all. God's not through yet. The French army was in control of Italy. They allowed the Pope to remain there under their control, under their power, and under their jurisdiction. By their permission, the Pope stayed there. But in 1798, I'm sorry, I have the wrong date there. In 1849, there was a conflict between Germany and France. Napoleon has long since passed. France and the French Revolution has long since passed. The Battle of Waterloo has long since passed, and so Napoleon is no more a threat. He's been exiled to the island of Elba, and there he dies. But the fact is, now France has a problem with Germany. And the French soldiers who are in control of Italy are called away in 1849 to fight the Germans. And in doing so, the French army removes their protection they had had. Now the people had rebelled against the Pope. They had put him into exile in 1849. Even the people of Italy didn't want their own Pope there. But later on, he was allowed to stay by the French army until in 1870, the French army was called away to fight the French. Victor Emmanuel arose as the king of Italy, and at his demand, with the authority of the Italian people, the Roman Catholic Church had its domain reduced and called the Vatican State to 108.7 acres. Now, of the vast domain he one time ruled, of the vast power he one time had, he could snap his finger and people all over the world would jump because he was the man of the day. For 1,260 years he had held this way. But from 1793, which is 1,260 years from when he first was crowned in 533, we have seen him lose power. Now he loses his territory. He loses the great territory he one time had until 108.7 acres. You don't know much about corn out here. We have a lot of corn fields bigger than that. If you know anything about golf courses, a lot of golf courses larger than that. It's the smallest independent nation on the face of the earth. Now, that's how his humility has come. The greatness, the power, the glory he one time had has now been reduced to 108.7 acres. That's the Vatican State. You can walk around it in 1 hour. Now, have you seen the Pope dethroned? Have you seen him brought low? Have you seen God pour his wrath upon him? Absolutely right. Now, Paul said that God is going to destroy him with the brightness of his coming. I don't expect the Pope to ever disappear as long as the world stands. But his power, his glory, his might, his significance, his influence has gone. He's been reduced to a minor person, and just like Italy itself, or Turkey, or some of the other nations who at one time figured in God's sight, Babylon, Iraq, Iran, Syria, all those have been reduced to a minor power, and so has the Pope, and that's precisely what God had in mind. However, the Pope at this time in 1870 entered into a self-imposed exile and rebelled against this and refused to accept it and would not have it and would not agree to it. And so he rebelled against this. He was in a self-imposed exile to the point that he did not leave and anything had to be brought into him. The Vatican State is an enclosed state. It has its own laws. Nobody can tamper with it, but it must depend on the outside for food and for sustenance. But here he is, exiled in his own estate. And from 1870 until 1929, he did not agree to that. But in 1929, under Pope Pius, he finally agreed. The Lateran Treaty under Benito Mussolini solved the problem, and finally the Pope agreed, here is my state, and I can be content with it. And this day, the Vatican State is that same size. We date that 1929. That's how far we've come up in the stream of time. We've come all the way from 30 A.D., up to 1929, and we have seen the Pope brought to his knees. The Vatican power has been limited. Its territory has been limited. It is no more than a second-rate religious group in the world today. And that's where it stands. God's brought it to its knees. It's losing its power. It's had rebellion after rebellion. Right now, the priests are leaving every day from it. They don't agree with it. It has internal strife to tear it apart. And I look for great devastation to come to it. But the fact is, here's where we stand on the fifth vow. We must stop there because, one thing, for time. And number two, I want to wait and talk about the sixth and seventh vow tomorrow night. Wish I could have gotten to chapter 17 tonight. I'm going to have to talk about it. Because 17 just summarizes in one chapter what we've talked about already. And pictures the Pope and the Catholic Church in a marvelous way. But not only that, it tells us the Catholic Church is a great whore. It talks about this whore having daughters. Now that's what we're going to have to talk about tomorrow night. Who is it? And who are the daughters? And what occurs in relationship to it? And how shall we know to avoid the things that we're going to talk about? But I've talked about an hour and a half. You've been so patient. I haven't seen a single one of you fall asleep tonight. I haven't seen anybody sigh tonight or even turn their head tonight. So God must have known how to put these things and make them interested, and he did. Because these things actually occurred. God knew about them. He knew about them 1,800 years before they occurred. What a mighty God we have. If God can know all these things and put all these things in such a beautiful picture as he has, wouldn't it be a wonderful God to serve in heaven forevermore? That's what I plan to be and do, and all of us, I'm sure, have that same intent in mind. Let me take one more moment, though, to mention something. There are those who, like myself, came from a sectarian background. I was reared with an idea of just anything who believed in God being all right. I attended a church where there was a beautiful old building. It had huge stones. It had ivy crawling over the side of them. Lovely stained glass windows. We had carpet on the floor and large curved oak seats. Beautiful organ that literally vibrated the entire building when we heard it. That was the background I was brought up in and I was used to, and that's all I knew. After a while, though, I became exposed to a friend of my mother to the Lord's Church. She very simply and humbly taught us the way of truth. And I saw very simply that all that glitters and glows and all those things were denomination in the world, even though it appears to society, was not pleasing to God. And I had to make a change. Now, I'm thankful I had the experience. Don't misunderstand what I said. I'm thankful I had the experience. Not that I was a sectarian, but that I had the experience to where I could see very clearly the distinction between being part of a counterfeit movement, one of the whore's daughters, and being part of God's spiritual kingdom. We had to be more humble. We had to accept more simple things. We had to be more honest with ourselves and look at ourselves as we really are. We have to look at God's word rather than listen to man's opinion, but there's a great contrast between the two. I'm so thankful I had that experience so I could see that difference. But there are some people who don't have that experience, and they can't know. Now, I don't want you to ever become a sectarian, but the fact is sometimes we're reared in a religious atmosphere to where we don't have that contrast made. And sometimes those who are reared among the members of the churches of Christ had never really seen the other side of it. All you know is peace and contentment in knowing that we have the truth. You have an understanding that there's not much to be done because you have good parents. You observe what the Bible says. There's not much decision to be made because you've always had a background of understanding this is the way it is. Now that's fine and that's well. To have been brought up, as it were, with a spiritual silver spoon in your mouth. You don't have to make the decision because your parents were godly, your brothers and sisters were godly, your grandparents were godly. You've never been exposed to the error of the world around, and that's good in a way. Many years ago, there were two girls who lived in England. They were well kept and all they wanted. And all the luxury, and all the pomp, and all the ceremony, and all the fine clothes they could desire. One day they were up in the castle where they lived, and they had a maid who took care of them and nurtured them. And they looked out the window, and they saw in the street below little kids running up and down having fun. Kids muddy in the mud, and getting dirty as they played, and having the dogs and the cats to play with, and kids coming up down the street with
laughing and having fun. The Queen of England is who I'm talking about now, but she turned to her sister and to the maid and she said, "Why can't we be like other kids and run and have fun like other kids do?" And the maid said, "Because you are the children of the king." And there's a difference. What a marvelous thing it is to be reared as children of the king and have an atmosphere that is conducive of us knowing the truth and being exposed to the truth, nothing else. What a joyous thing that must be. The fact is, it can be misused. We can be lulled asleep with the complacency of not making decisions. Tonight, have you made the proper decision to obey your Lord? You can't be saved on your mother's skirt tail, on your father's coat tail. You can't go to heaven because your great-grandfather was a member of the Lord's church. You can't go to heaven just because you come to the church house every day, every Sunday, and every time the doors open and are faithful in that. That must be a decision made in your life. Have you made that decision to put God first, to be born again? You know what it is to be born again? You're born once. We're going to talk about this probably Sunday morning. You were born once, but you must be born again. You see, the first time, you didn't have a thing in the world to do with it. Your father and your mother made the decision, and you were born into a family. You didn't even choose the name. You didn't choose your sex. You didn't choose your color. You were born automatically with not a thing in the world you had to do with it. But the second time you're born again, you make the decision. You determine the time. You determine whether you will or will not. And that's the important birth. That's the important decision, and one you must make yourself. Have you made the decision to be born again to God's kingdom? By virtue of God's Spirit and immersion in water forgiveness of your sins, you can become a member of His spiritual family and for the first time become somebody of your own worth because you've made the decision to follow God and to make heaven your home. Think seriously about that tonight while we stand and sing this song. And if your choice is to obey your Lord, let us know your wish by simply stepping forward, giving us your hand so we know. Would you come while we sing?